Hello, everyone. Welcome to Creative Therapy Umbrella, the place where we talk about lots of things, creative arts therapy, expressive therapies, and creative approaches to therapy. If you are enjoying listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways that you can support us. The first is leaving a review for us on iTunes. Even if you subscribe or rate us as well, that makes us really visible to other podcast listeners who may not know about us yet. So if you have a minute, go subscribe, rate, or review us, and that can make such a difference. And for those of you who have already done that, I appreciate that so, so much. Also, we do have a Patreon page, so if you're interested in getting more resources from this podcast, you can head over to our Patreon, and that link is below in our show notes. And there's different tiers that you can subscribe to, and you get different types of benefits, including swag, extra bonus episodes, interview opportunities, and a lot of other fun things. On today's episode, I talk with Melissa Diaz, who is a registered art therapist and licensed creative arts therapist. She has such a great background working with so many different populations, and it's really awesome to hear her current work as she works with clients, but then is also an instructor as well, and she has this really cool balance that she does right now. Melissa does a bunch of really cool things. She shares some different topics that she does with some of her groups, and she dives into the creative process in general, as well as specifically the art process. And we definitely go on a rant on Bob Ross, which was pretty amazing. So I just had so much fun listening to Melissa, and hearing her passion was just amazing. All right, guys, thanks for listening and enjoy the episode. Okay, Melissa, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited.
Me too. I'm glad we're doing this. And I think it's a great, I got connected to you through Mika, who I think is on, I think she's episode 4. I interviewed Mika and she had referred you to me. So I was like, great, I need more art therapists to talk to. So it worked out great.
That's kind of a nice way to keep the podcast going too, yes. Just to like referral to referral.
Yeah. And I usually ask. Yes. Because it's especially me being primarily a music therapist, I have some art therapists that I've worked with before and some play therapists, but it can be really hard to find other. So it's like tapping into those networks. And I found it the hardest with drama therapy. That one I was like, man, I'm searching for you guys. So if you're out there, send me an email because I would love to do an interview.
I have them.
Yes.
I have some good ones.
Awesome. Yes. Oh, that makes me so happy.
Drama therapists.
Wonderful. Well. I've never worked with a drama therapist and I'm so jealous because it's like, it sounds so amazing. What they do is so cool.
I've definitely done some experientials with them too, and it's so interesting to be on that side of things and how vulnerable I am towards doing the dramatic work and the drama therapy work, and yet I ask that of my clients in the art therapy work. So it's like I really have embodied that kind of vulnerable feeling because it is so far out from how I practice or how I naturally am. It's always really, it's really cool. It's interesting.
I love that. I feel like that's something I think I've talked about in supervision, or that we ask vulnerability, especially creativity is a hard one. I think, you know, culturally we can kind of be like, I can't sing. I don't want to sing. Or I know with art, I'm like, ugh, I can, you know, paint some dots, but I can't like make anything. But we're asking our clients to do that all the time. So it's really cool when we're in that position and it's like, oh, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. And the drama like embodies it and ticks it up. So
yes. Yeah. I love that. Oh, I'm excited. Cool. I guess like I'm just going to keep asking and just keep telling people like send me people.
Like, kind of a nice way to also be like growing your community too. That's kind of special.
Yes. And that's why I really like that too, because then there's, people are connected. It's like an interconnected web in that way, mm-hmm. of like not just random people, but then there's people who are connected, and mm-hmm. like the, what I'm hoping is that people who are listening hear somebody that they're interested in and then reach out to them. And then there's somebody else you can reach out to too, who's down the line, and they know each other. So it's just like this great, it's kind of, I don't know, I think of a spider web in a way.
I was going to say, it's a nice web. It's a little creativity web.
yeah. I like that. Oh, that's like a nice design I could dive into.
I see it.
Okay. Well, for our Would You Rather today, we are doing a Thanksgiving related one, because we are recording the day before Thanksgiving, and I think this is going to be out the week after Thanksgiving, so we're kind of in that holiday season. But mm-hmm. This was a funny one, and it I wanted to ask this one because I had used it with some of the kids that I work with, and they thought it was like the most hilarious thing ever. So I was like, okay, this is a fun one to be playful with. So it is, would you rather take a bath in gravy or wash your hair with mashed potatoes?
Oh, that's a really good one. You know, okay. So it also brings up associations for me. But I feel like the mashed potatoes and the hair would be like a nice hair treatment. I feel like it could be like a really nice massaging of the mashed potatoes and the hair, maybe like a hair mask, leave it in for a little bit, hardens, wash it out.
Oil, like, you know, sour cream in the mashed potatoes,
some starch for my hair. Mm-hmm. The gravy seems very unappealing to me. And I'm thinking, like, what temperature, how does it stay at that temperature? How thick is this gravy?
Wow. Well, you can ask questions too. I always say, like, if you want to ask questions about it to help you decide, I can make up random answers.
I think that any type of gravy, I'd probably not be into it. Mm-hmm. But my association was, when I first moved to New York, I lived with one of my best friends, and we did Friendsgiving for years and years. And we had a tiny, tiny, tiny apartment with the tiniest kitchen, and we would share in cooking in that kitchen. And I am vegan, and she's not, which is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. But she was making the turkey and the gravy, and she was basting the turkey, and somehow it kind of fell, and all these turkey juices got all over, like all the like basting juices.
Oh no.
I know. And it was just like hit my bare legs, and I was just, it was fine actually. Mm-hmm. But it's this funny thing that I think of every Thanksgiving, because my lovely best friend still apologizes and still like really holds this memory as like something she did, and I'm just like, it was an accident, but it made me think of the gravy, and I think it'd be unpleasant.
It would bring back those traumatic memories. It would be yes, totally. Oh my gosh, I love that. I love that you have that association with. I'm so sorry that it's not a good one in a way, but it's also sounds like it is kind of sweet that it's like a sweet moment that you had with your friend.
Very sweet. It's very sweet, and she's one of my dearest friends, and I could love care that. Less.
Yes,
but it was gross.
She's worth it. Yes. Yep. It was funny because I did ask that one on Instagram, and it was one that kind of like toggled back and forth between like, oh, more people are going with gravy. And then it was like, no, mashed potatoes is coming back. And it was kind of going back and forth. And I think it landed that more people would do mashed potatoes in their hair.
Okay.
Yes.
I feel good about that.
And I never thought of until you said it, the temperature and the consistency of the gravy. I never even thought about that, of like, you know, all these different elements of can really dissect it.
What would you do?
I think I actually, I vote on them too. When I initially put them out, I'm like, okay, I'm going to vote also. And I voted for gravy. I know. And, but it's funny because I didn't think about it in thinking about, like, I didn't think about temperature and I didn't think about consistency, but I thought about, like, I don't know. There was something within my hair. I was like, I don't know if I would like the consistency of mashed potatoes, like in my hair. Like, what would that feel like? Would it be really heavy? Yeah. Yeah. And then now I'm thinking of, are they thick mashed potatoes? Yeah, you can go so many places.
I teach a materials class at Pratt. So I think I'm also just like really tuned in to like, how can we describe the nuances of materials? So just like thinking of gravy as a material, like, but what's it made of? What's in there? How would you feel if it was thick or thin?
Yes. I love that. What a cool, can you tell us a little bit more about that? What you do with your teaching? What
that looks like? Yeah, I'm a visiting instructor at Pratt. So I'm teaching this semester first year materials and second year supervision. And so the materials class is really each week we go through a different material that may be used in your art therapy practice, but different than learning directives. It's really kind of embodying what the material experience is for you. What are your thoughts, associations, feelings, emotions? What's your process? And I've tried to preface it as, so if you're coming to art therapy school from a fine arts background, sometimes entering this class, and I remember very well being in this position, can be a little challenging or awkward because you're so used to creating to make a product, to make something that's going to be critiqued or shown. And so it's like kind of retraining your brain to think about art in the way that maybe what originally brought you to art making, your inner experience.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. We go through kind of drawing materials, paint. We go from kind of dry to fluid and resistant materials and kind of what it brings up. But yeah, it's really fun and interesting to think about the way we see art and how we're often really trained in the product of it. So to kind of really delve into the process brings up a lot.
Yeah. And there is so, it's so detailed. Like, I love how that gets down to the nitty gritty of some stuff of, you know, like, now I can see it too, thinking about like mashed potatoes and gravy of, well, what is it? What does it look like? What does it smell like? What does it feel like? Mm-hmm. And it's funny because I feel like, especially as someone who is, I don't have any art training. I do like to like make art and do small. I like to knit and like, you know, things like that, that are somewhat art-based, but like material wise, I feel like I've never put that much thought into it. And now I feel like that's such a really cool thing to like keep in the forefront. It's so mindful, I feel like, in a way to like keep that in the forefront of your mind.
Yeah. And it's hard. It's really hard. Our inner critic pops up. It's such visual, it's materials and you're creating something. So it's visual and you automatically go to that place of, is this how it should look? Is this how I wanted it to look? So it is really a practice in mindfulness and being able to kind of hear that and return back. So it's been a lot of fun for me. Hopefully it's been fun for my students. Maybe some challenges. We just worked with wood carving yesterday. That was not a favorite. It's just a very resistant material. So it's definitely not doing what you wanted to do, unlike clay where you're kind of molding and you could feel it. You have an idea of where it's going to go. The wood kind of surprises you sometimes. And depending on where you're at, that could be just like really not fun.
Totally triggering. I could see for some, you know, if it's, you're having control issues or something's happening that you're, I work with children who have life-limiting illnesses. So control mm-hmm. always comes up as a big thing. Of course. Like, yeah. And that would be something where I could see where it would just be so difficult of like, why isn't this doing the thing I want it to do, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and how, and then even as adults getting, or, you know, not adults, but students in the creative arts therapy field getting trained.
Well, they're
in
adults.
That. Yeah. Yeah. They are both. Yes.
Yeah. And that's why I think I kind of try to reiterate that you're kind of retraining your brain in a way to how the context in which you have maybe thought about creating. But yeah, you definitely, it's definitely a practice in mindfulness and a practice in hearing your inner critic or your inner negative self-talk and kind of making a choice of kind of just going with that and fighting with the material, which is actually a good practice when you can have that opportunity. Or how can you continue to bring yourself back to your senses, which kind of can get you a little bit out of that mind space. But it takes quite a bit of practice and a while to get to a place of kind of hearing that inner critic and then coming back to the piece and back to the material. And it's a nice parallel with the work that we do with what we're asking of our clients. So it really helps you embody that experience as well, especially people who are coming to art, maybe for the first time ever, maybe for the first time since they were children. Maybe their concept of art was the last time they were in school making art. Like, so it definitely gives you that embodied practice. And then is a parallel to kind of so many things in our life or that are not in our control. And like, where can we solve that problem? Can we problem solve? Do we have the coping skills for that? Or do we just radically accept that this isn't going exactly how I want it to go? And at the same time, how can I move through? Mm-hmm. So I definitely bring up radical acceptance quite a bit in this class. But it's also a lot of fun. It's materials, and that's our main thing. There's always the therapist, the client, or the group, and the materials.
Yeah. It's like a, in music therapy, I've joked about this a lot with music therapy of like, I always have my guitar on my back and it feels like a limb, like your instrument, yes. Even if it's your voice, is like your other limb of being a therapist. And I would imagine, like you're saying, that's what materials are.
Yeah. I always think as a, like kind of a relationship of three.
Yeah. I love that. Yes. Yes. A relationship of three. It's funny. That whole concept of how you talked about there's that mindful piece, but then you can bring your senses back into it and you can get out of your mind. I love that, talking about that and just like hearing about that space and what that looks like for clients, for therapists, because it's interesting. You can get so caught up in intellectualizing stuff, or you can get so caught up in just feeling stuff, and then being able to go back and forth and have that connection between the two.
Yeah. I mean, especially right now at this time and holidays coming up, and also it's like the end of the first semester for my students, and we're all living in New York trying to kind of hustle and bustle through that lifestyle and what you want to accomplish and kind of a high achieving community here. So it comes up often. Yeah.
Yeah. And the end of a decade is another thing people have been saying.
Oh my goodness. I didn't even think about that.
I know. That's another one where I'm like, wow, it's a big transition. It feels like this is a big transition time, you know? Yeah, for sure. Well, and like you said, with the hustle and bustle busyness, you do so many different things. And besides teaching, can you tell us a little bit about what else you do currently?
Sure. So currently I am a therapist at New York Creative Arts Therapists and the Williamsburg and Bushwick location. They also have a Cold Spring location. I think we're the first kind of solo art therapy practice. And now through the years, they've incorporated other creative arts therapy modalities. That's why I know some drama therapists.
Yeah.
We have some movement therapists, music therapists. But it's basically a private practice space. So I run two burnout groups, actually. So I could talk a little bit more about that too.
Yeah.
And I run a women's art therapy group, and I've just started a mindfulness-based art therapy group that is very slowly coming together. Nice. And then I see adults, I see a handful, a couple of children, and one teen. So I specialized in working with adults with mental illness for many, many years of my work. In my last position, I was an assistant director at an outpatient mental health facility. And so I transitioned to this position right after summer, like right in September. Mm-hmm. So it's a very different position than some of the agency work that I've been doing. And it's an interesting shift. It's really cool. Everyone's bright, and it's a really nice practice. I've known the owners for like 8 years or so, because they also are part of the art therapy community. I've shown my artwork there. I've had benefits show there. They have a little waiting room gallery space that now I'm curating. One of my very good friends, Cheryl Walpole, works there, and that's a part of how I got connected. And she's an inspiring art therapist, and actually we all, Mika, myself, Cheryl, we all graduated together. So that's where I'm at now. Previous to that, I have worked in many, many different sites and populations. I've really had a chance to kind of run the gamut of kind of working with, like I said before, I've done a lot of work inpatient and outpatient with adults with mental illness. I've also worked with children on the spectrum in the preschool setting. I've done some shelter work in family shelters and domestic violence shelters. I've done some work with the Epilepsy Foundation in an open studio program there. And then in my last position, I got to kind of build the art therapy program. So that was
a special
thing to leave behind. So those are some of my jobs, I think.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. And then I also run an organization called Open House Brooklyn that I've had for 9, 10 years. And it started as kind of a community exhibition series and shows taking place in apartments and lofts and backyards, multidisciplinary music, art, performance, interactive pieces. And it was really just a response to how many creative individuals were around me and how difficult it is sometimes to get the venue to have the gallery space, to have an accessible space to show, to have an accessible community. So it started that way. And then through that, I started doing some workshops and some art therapy workshop. And a good friend of mine who's a yoga instructor, Christina Danello, worked with me on a kids' art and movement group. So now at this point, we do kind of, I would say maybe one to two shows a year, kind of whittled down. I was trying to keep it for every other month and then seasonal. And now this is kind of where it's at. So we did a really big benefit show for Puerto Rico and Hurricane Maria. We recently participated in Gowanus Open Studios. Primarily the headquarters is my apartment. I have a fairly large studio space and a backyard. So the past shows in the past few years have taken place here. I've had some workshops here. So it's really just a community arts initiative to make kind of the arts accessible, less precious, and a source of networking. A lot of people have made connections and then played together, showed together. Yeah, and it's all affordable or it's a benefit for an organization. So that I'm doing, it's always like kind of in the background of my life. Mm-hmm.
What started for Open House Brooklyn? Where did the kind of catalyst happen that was like, I need to, something's missing, or I need to make this, or this isn't accessible? What was that like for you?
Yeah, a part of it stemmed from my undergrad experience. I was a part of a collective in undergrad where we had a rotation of shows out of a home that one of the members, it was their home. And it was just such a nice way to bring in the visitor and have them really be a co-creator in the show. Like, it's more intimate. You already just kind of feel different than the white wall gallery space. It makes the work more tangible, the artist more tangible. So I had that experience and I remember how lovely it was and how important it felt. And then I've been in the South Slope community. I've been living here for 12 years. So it was just a time where actually everyone like in my closest vicinity were artists and musicians. And my mind just went to kind of bringing us together. How can we support one another? How can we form a networking community? How can we form a safe space where we can kind of workshop, test out some things that you want to show or play? And then also kind of bring in the audience or visitors or guests in a way that they feel comfortable and that they're participating in some sense as well, whether that's even just like having a DJ at the end and we're all dancing. I've had a lot of interactive, like giant spin art tables. So yeah, I think the impetus was the experience I had had while I was getting my BFA. So there was like my school education and then this collective I was in that really brought a lot to my identity of how I want to work as an artist and how I want to participate in the community. So it just felt natural to bring that here when all of my neighbors were kind of creative individuals.
Yeah. And what a, like, what an amazing and beautiful, I would imagine, place for everybody to be together. Like, artist, community, like, just it all like kind of flows into each other, which just sounds so cool.
Yeah. It has been a lot of fun, and just like the openness of individuals who were willing to host and like bring a whole bunch of artists and individuals into your home, into your backyard, into your loft, into your, so that's, I think, really kind of a special piece of it too, the intimate spot. And I personally just prefer alternative spaces because you kind of have to work with what the space is kind of telling you, kind of similar to the non-control and working with the resistance of materials. You kind of have to work with the space. It's not just clear, blank, beautiful walls, which are, you know, don't get me wrong, those are nice too. Yeah. But you kind of have to build a relationship with the space as well.
Yeah. I love that. That makes you think outside of the box a little bit more of, you know, literally. I mean, I think some, you know, if it's just a kind of square gallery, which is beautiful, it is, because you just have your attention is so much on the art. But I think that space sounds really, that intimate space is really nice too. It feels more cozy, and I feel like I would be able to be more vulnerable or like ask questions more in a space like that, you know.
Absolutely. I mean, I hope so.
Yeah.
And some of them are art parties, and they're just, you know, a joyous
celebration. So that's so cool, because that's so, I love how it's so multimodal, you know, bringing in all of those pieces together. And now, you said also at the current place that you work, it's multimodal as well. There's, you're working with other, was it drama and music too?
So different than a program, we don't kind of share any of the same cases per se, or in kind of running a therapeutic services together, but we do meet as a group once a week. And so what's cool about that is really getting to hear different points of view in regards to case presentations, in regards to just kind of how we're thinking about how we're working. So what's cool is that the foundation is creative, right? And then our lens is all kind of just a little bit different. So it gives a little aha time.
Yeah. And I feel like is what part of why I started this podcast is having that same thing of just hearing a different perspective. That's also a very creative perspective and how much it can like just send off light bulbs and plant seeds. And that's awesome.
Yeah. And there's a decent amount of us. Now they have all of those modalities and we have some interns. So awesome. Yeah, so it's wonderful to hear all the opinions, and every now and then it's like, oh no, there's too many. I don't know. Let me take this all in, you guys, and I'm gonna like integrate, ingest, and see.
Go process this and figure out what one sits with me. And yes, I was just talking to somebody about that, about internships and how awesome it is to be in a place where you have multiple therapists that you like observe with or that you work with as an intern, because you get that, which is really overwhelming, but then you're like, ooh, this one resonates with me.
Yeah.
I'm not sure about this one. Maybe I'll tuck it back for later or something. Mm-hmm. And that's awesome. That sounds like I would
like
imagine
gain your styles.
Yes.
What you're going to put together, piece of you, piece of this experience.
Yes. A giant puzzle. Yes. That's awesome. So you had mentioned some really cool groups. You'd mentioned burnout groups. Can you tell us a little bit about some of those groups and what they look like?
Sure. So the burnout group I inherited, it was, it's something that Drina Fagan, who is one of the co-founders of New York Creative Arts Therapist, started up. So I've kind of jumped in her shoes in one group, although not being able to wear her shoes. She's been doing this for a long time, kind of specializing in this burnout topic. But I also started a new group with new individuals, new helping professionals. So it doesn't, not even necessarily just clinicians. I have lawyers in my group, social workers. There's a dance movement therapist. So it's also coming from different points of view. And what I've gathered is, and I've definitely had my fair share of burnout myself, so I definitely know the full embodied experience and kind of getting to an existential place of kind of like, what is happening? Where am I? What is this system? It really can affect your body, your mind, your life, your everything. And so what's been interesting is kind of breaking that down, and for myself, kind of training myself and learning more about not only what brings it on, but the different nuances. So the different nuances between compassion fatigue and secondary trauma, vicarious trauma, and burnout, and how there are all these kind of subtle differences under the umbrella of compassion fatigue. So that's, and it's also just really validating. So in kind of working with bringing that out, it's something we talked about in the last group that I started, kind of looking through, and getting that validation of like, oh, I'm not crazy. I'm not, not well. Maybe you're not feeling well, but that you're not, it's not your fault. And I think naturally as clinicians, right, we are introspective. We're kind of thinking about approaches and how to do the work. But I think we're also been that way at times to a detriment to ourselves. So like, what can I do to be better? Why is this not feeling good? Why is this not working this way? When maybe it's actually a systemic issue beyond the individual. Mm-hmm. And then talking about, well, when you're in these spaces, how do you, if you can't leave, if that's not an option. How do you protect yourself? How do you maintain some self-care? Or how do you even just work with your thinking so that it doesn't flood your experiences? So one group is really fresh. We just started. We've had 3 sessions. Mm-hmm. And I impart some mindfulness work. So I try to start that at the beginning, and similar to what I do at the beginning of classes too. It's like, it's really difficult to kind of come to the table and quiet our thoughts. And this group takes place like after the workday. So there's a lot kind of bubbling. So it's definitely not easy to enter and just have your thoughts drop away. So, yes. But it's primarily open studio and non-directive. I impart a theme, or intentions, and yeah, so that's kind of a new, journey for me that I just started. I've run ton of groups. I mean, I really like to specialize in group work. Mm-hmm. But this is definitely a new venue for me. Yeah. And the other group that I just started is mindfulness based and art making. Mm-hmm. So learning about what mindfulness is, distinguishing between kind of everyday mindfulness and meditation, that meditation is mindful, but you don't have to be meditating to be mindful. And compassion, kind of really where can we add some compassion to the pieces of ourselves that we're very hard on. And also kind of using our senses in that group. The last thing we did was, and this was actually a little exploration in control and letting go. We did some wet on wet watercolor initially, which is very fluid. And once you put the watercolor on the wet on wet paper, it just kind of moves on its own. And we were also working with ink. So once you drop that ink on, it expands. You can pick the paper up and roll around the paper. So that's the initial step where you're kind of giving in to the material, noticing your thoughts and noticing your feelings in your body when you have less control. And then once you've added the drops, bringing your control back. And what are you going to create with these pieces? So you can kind of have both sections of that experience.
Yeah, that sounds like a beautiful process.
Yeah, it was, and actually they're really fun pieces. Mm-hmm. Getting to see that kinetic piece too with the ink kind of expanding, being able to move it, having to deal with kind of it streaming the other way, and what does that bring up for us? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It sounds like so playful, you know, like in a mindfulness way of that is such a playful place to be.
Yes. Yeah. And I think I try to impart that because it's also the group members' time. It's their space. It's their time. And, you know, you want it to be therapeutic, but you also want it to be joyful and, you know, a moment of respite. So that group just started up. And it's also in that group and in other groups I've run really talking about coping skills, like not only training in mindfulness through the art making, but then talking about it, how this might apply in other areas of our life.
And how that can transition out of the therapy room. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. And that's such an important thing. I feel like we're to remember that we want it to happen outside too, and not just inside and keeping it moving for sure.
And I think sometimes it's just internalized and naturally it's happening kind of the strength you're building is lending itself to other areas. Yeah. But I've found for the mindfulness work I've been doing, actually naming it and where you might apply this in other areas is really helpful, because that's kind of also what I'm asking you to do, is to kind of name your experience, name your thought, name your senses, So actually being really kind of concrete about how we can apply this in other areas.
Yeah. I remember learning this when listening to Tara Brach has this really great podcast about mindfulness, and she's a psychotherapist, I believe, and or has a doctorate in psychology. I'm not sure if it's clinical psychologist, but she kind of brings in mindfulness and psychotherapy, and that whole naming the process is so powerful. And there's research that it like it brings your brain into a different place. Like it's such a healing thing to do by naming it. And then I love that you're taking that such a, another cool step of like, okay, now where would we use this somewhere else? This is what it feels like. We're experiencing it. And now what does it look like in other places?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, I mean, my base, because I have not always practiced primarily with mindfulness at the root of my work. I think in the past couple of years, I've really shifted that way. And a part of it was for myself. I mean, a part of it was how I was working with how I'm coping with the things I want to accomplish, the things I'm doing, the unknown, being a New Yorker, just all the things we have to do to get done, traveling, commuting. How to make things a less kind of grueling or heavy or work experience. But also my last job, I trained myself and got some supervision and training from my supervisor in DBT work. So that's really where I kind of delved into the mindfulness piece. And DBT was started by Marsha Linehan, and she also was someone who had borderline personality, and DBT is primarily for borderline personality, but also has just such good modules and tenets in general. And the mindfulness piece came from her kind of studying Zen Buddhism and bringing it in to kind of the Eastern kind of world, like many people that have kind of integrated or appropriated. I mean, she names it, so I think kind of naming it takes some of that appropriation away. But that's how I grew to understood mindfulness, because in DBT it talks about observing, describing, one mindfully, trying to do one thing at a time, non-judgmental. And so those skills helped me understand it and take some of the pressure off, right? Because I think what I see often and what I've experienced, if we do a mindfulness practice, many people end it feeling like they did it wrong, like it didn't work, because they couldn't just quiet their thoughts. And really validating that that's where you should be. It is incredibly hard.
Yes.
It's a practice, just like training for something or yoga is a practice. There's no way that that's okay. I think learning mindfulness through the DBT lens, where it's really about observing what's coming up for you and describing that to yourself. So kind of getting some space from those thoughts, taking the driver's seat or taking the wheel, allowing yourself to know that it's okay if your mind wanders and to come back, even if you have to do it like a million times. And that in doing that, you kind of build that up in your system. And that it takes a while. And there's so many ways to actually be succeeding in it. So that's been a kind of fascinating piece for myself, because I'm often trying to have moments where I bring myself back mindfully all day, every day.
And it is, it really is hard. I like the explanation of how it is like a muscle. Like you wouldn't just go try to run a marathon and then, you know, like it's your brain, you also have to like work that muscle of bringing yourself back and then being okay when it goes away, because it's gonna, your mind's gonna get distracted, but mm-hmm. like the practice of doing that is the practice. Like that's the mindfulness practice. Yeah.
And I think also too, in doing it in a group setting, when I do it, when I work with my students or groups, kind of the validation you get and support that when maybe we're at the end of the group and sharing, or we finished a mindfulness practice talking about it, and that almost everyone probably had the exact same experience. Mm-hmm. So that kind of validating, I'm not alone in this. It's natural. I'm not expected to be a Buddhist monk guru. That, you know, there's many different ways to be mindful and to interpret it and to make it your own. And at the same time, I like to do kind of pay homage to where these original tenets came from, that it didn't just come from the Eastern world out of nowhere from psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really important too, to like have that piece of honor, I guess, like paying that respect to that, especially mindfulness being such a long tradition in history, having elements of that is really, really cool.
Yeah. I also do that with, I mean, in art therapy, we do a lot of mandala making. That's like a pretty big directive that I think most art therapists would say that they've done that with their clients or their individual sessions. So that's another area where I also try to start, if we're working with mandalas, which can also be a mindfulness activity or a grounding activity, to also kind of start off the group with a history of mandala making and kind of where did this come from? Like, is it like the Tibetan monks who were making sand mandalas, or the Navajos also used mandalas, and how were they used in rituals? Well, and so that there's a much bigger history than art therapy, because I think mandalas are also so present in all of these art therapy coloring books. And so also naming that and paying homage and respect, mandalas especially feel very appropriated to me. And at the same time, I love working with them.
Yes. So kind
of balancing that out.
Yeah. And how I think too, is I would imagine if I'm in an art therapy group and we're doing mandalas, and without the history, I'm also just a total history nerd, so I really love that stuff anyway. But I think if there wasn't that directive there, I think it could be a very like, not lonely, but like subjective place. But when you bring in that history piece, it makes it so much more, like it brings you into the world more of like, wow, like this is, you know, here's where this comes from, which is not only an important piece to show that respect, but then I would think too, as an individual, like you're making a bigger connection for individuals of kind of feeling the world as a bigger place than doing your mandala in, you know, a room here, you know, which is amazing. But then you have that other piece, which is really cool.
Yeah, and that the circle is a symbol, and it comes up so much, and it's a symbol for so many different things. Circle of life, circle of friends. Mm-hmm. It's a common object in nature, actually. So like when Jung kind of involved mandalas and brought that into his work and into his client work, it was about universalities. That's kind of what you are speaking to. It does kind of, knowing that adds to that experience.
Yeah. And it reminds me, I get this feeling when I hike, because like if I go out hiking, like you get out of your space and like you feel, it's very humbling because you're out and you're in nature and the weather can change any second and who knows what's around the corner. And I love that feeling, that it just makes you feel like your size in a world. And it kind of just brings this whole new perspective to what you're actively doing. And I feel like that would talking about that would make me feel that way also, and bring in just a different element, you know, to that, that mindfulness process, and putting things into a bigger perspective, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, totally.
I love that. Yeah. That's awesome. And it's so interesting too, hearing about like all of the symbolism, like especially like Jung's work, you know, so much how stuff is symbolized. And how does that come up for some of your groups in art in general? I would imagine, you know, in music, it's metaphor. Metaphor comes up constantly with lyrics, and sometimes it does with, you know, music. If, you know, you're talking about spaceships and your music line goes up, you know, different things like that. But what's that been like for you in some of the group work that you do?
I think there's a couple things that happen. I think that at times there are individuals where the symbolism is actually the process, and what that is symbolizing about a piece of themselves and a piece of the way that they operate in the world. So not even the kind of product, the visual, but just the process itself. And so, and then the symbolism, I like to, at the end of groups, actually hold up the artwork for the individuals, not in an infantilizing way, but often when we're working, we are very close and we're kind of at one in the process, right? And kind of the way you just described hiking and gaining this perspective, even just kind of getting the art piece a couple feet out of right in your face kind of lends itself to visual perspective, but also mental perspective as well. So in that way, the symbolism changes, I think, when we start to kind of talk about the work. I often just ask, what do we have? What do we see? Kind of just describe, and sometimes even through describing the shapes and colors comes a deeper symbol or a discovery. And then sometimes I'll ask groups if they feel comfortable with feedback, right? So giving kind of compassionate inquiry if other group members have questions, or if they kind of, or if something is really resonates with them, but also contracting beforehand to make sure that everyone feels safe about that, about giving feedback. I think of it as kind of a art therapy based critique. Mm-hmm. So in that way, symbolism pops out in the product. But it really comes through the kind of closing piece after discussing either what do we have, what do we see, or if you don't want to talk about the piece, how did you feel while you were creating? What thoughts came up? What feelings came up? Was it similar to any other thoughts and experiences or feelings you have in other areas? And that way it links to some symbolism as well.
Yeah, those are both such cool ways of how... I can't think of the word, how much symbolism is just ever present in so much of what we do, but it's not always in our attention, you know, yeah. Like it's not always there. And the process I think of even digging into, oh, like that, I love that, like pulling back and kind of stepping out of yourself of, you said compassionate inquiry. That's just such a great way to label, you know, having those honest conversations in a safe space where you're ready to like, yeah, let's mm-hmm. talk about it. What does that mean? I'm really curious why you used this instead of this. Mm-hmm. And then what does that mean for both people? I feel like this, that could just perpetually go down so many really therapeutic spaces.
Yeah. And sometimes it also, especially for individuals who are maybe in a rigid way of thinking about themselves and their experiences, to get offered another perspective from another individual really can offer some opportunity for increased mentalizing, to kind of be able to see the other side, the other perspectives, to see that other people have other perspectives. Mm-hmm. So that can be really neat too. And the compassionate inquiry has been something that I started using when I started teaching, because as, you know, as students, and it's a 2-year program, so there's no way you could learn everything, and there's no way you're going to come out of the program as an expert. You're still kind of, your training will continue when you graduate, and kind of allow yourself to be an art therapist in training these 2 years. So, but what happens often, and I definitely remember it in myself, is like wanting to get it right. Kind of thinking about missteps in your group or with a client when you're an intern, how it can feel like a failure, or how it can feel like you're not good enough. I should be able to do this like so-and-so, the comparisons. And so I often bring up compassionate inquiry in class for yourself. So instead of going to that place of like, oh, that directive sucked, that whole thing was a mess and I don't feel good about it. And sure, you can have those feelings too. But if you want to kind of be introspective and allow yourself to kind of think about it, how can you also not beat yourself up or try to move away from the judgment piece and compassionately kind of ask yourself about like, where were you? Where was the group? Where was the individual? What could I have done differently? What went wrong? What went right? What were these successes? Because it's really hard, I think, especially when you're training, to not immediately go to that kind of harsher place.
Yeah. And I think I still feel that at times where like something happens in a session, and it's like, oh, what happened? What did I do? Why didn't I do it this way?
We will always feel that.
I think that's always gonna, but I think like you're saying too, like it's almost like it's information. Like, you know, like your body is telling, or your mind is, both are saying like, take this information, like go hash this out. There's this really great, I think this is in Lisa Dion's book, Aggression and Play Therapy, but it's this topic. And it's, she has a reflection in the book where you list out all of the things that, like the negative things of like, what are you afraid happening? I'm afraid it's going to go wrong. I'm afraid the client's going to get upset. I'm afraid I'm not doing the right thing. And then you take those things and you find positives of what would happen if that happened. Like, play that scenario out, which is a common thing of like, okay, if the client gets upset with me, then I have an opportunity to apologize, which is a great thing in therapy to have that, you know, repair happen of like, oh, that honesty, that vulnerability from the therapist. And then, you know, and I think in the reflection, it's like list 20 things and, you know, just, and it's like this big tree. I think it just kind of keeps going in these branches, but it's such a really cool way to look at what we're feeling on the surface and then find all these other opportunities. That's like, if I make a mistake, then I can apologize. That's great. You know, like that's a great therapeutic thing. And it brings that like compassion back to those things of being human in therapy. Yeah.
Yeah. I want to take that. That's so good.
I'll put that link to her book in the show notes too, because it's a great, it's so applicable to so many different therapeutic avenues, because it's a therapist as self work. But I love it. There's so much compassion in it of, you know, giving yourself permission to be human.
Yeah. And it takes it one step further to actually think of the what if. So like list out. So that's kind of a step further than I go with my students and clients sometimes. That's really cool.
Yeah. And it definitely shifts that perspective, I think, of thinking, you know, these like, I don't want to say, I hate saying good or bad, but like these bad things that we label in our minds as like, that was a bad thing that happened. But so many good things can come from a bad thing, you know, of that is showing the natural human relationship, which is something in therapy we want to highlight, you know? So it's, I think it changes it from like bad things to opportunities.
Yeah. And it also kind of reminds me of the art making process in itself. And I think maybe similar for music too, the kind of happy accident, kind of reconciling when we made a plan for what we want this to look like. But then due to the material or our human hand, or it didn't go how you wanted. And now you have to reconcile and revisit how the piece is going to move forward. And oftentimes in my own work, it's kind of made it better than maybe what I thought it was going to be, but it does take a lot of letting go and acceptance and kind of trusting in the process. And I think that's also based on our ego strength and what areas it's easier to do that, what areas it's much harder to do that.
Yeah.
I know that in my artwork, I've gotten to a place where it's exciting and easy, not easy, but a challenge that feels kind of enjoyable and not so burdensome as maybe, you know, like 15 or 16 years ago when I'm maybe longer. When I don't remember when I was in art school, but it was a long time. How kind of the mistake can really kind of be jarring or kind of set you into a place of kind of questioning in a really judgmental way. I think the art making process is also kind of giving you a lesson in that as well.
Exactly. I feel so strongly about that too. And I immediately thought of a couple clients that I've worked with and clients on the autism spectrum who can sometimes struggle, depending on the client, but sometimes struggle with the non-concrete or the not right and wrong and those spaces in between that can create really beautiful things. And that's, I feel like that's exactly like that process of, you know, hey, that B flat sounded really cool, even though it was a mistake. Like that's how really cool or really beautiful things sometimes happen. Those, is it Bob Ross who says happy little accidents?
Yeah, I think so. Or happy little trees.
Happy little trees. There's not, for some reason, it's like, why did Bob Ross just pop into my head when I said happy little accident? But it's so like that acceptance of that
He did talk about accidents.
Did he? Yeah.
Because he would make it into anything.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And so I feel like he does it in just that accepting, completely accepting way. That I strive to get to one day, how, you know, in that place.
He was a therapeutic being.
And his animals, the animals he would always bring on. I loved that.
Yeah. There is a book. Oh, and I feel terrible that I don't remember the name.
Oh, no, that's okay.
I will look it up and I'll let you know.
Yeah. I'll put it in the show notes.
About different perspectives. Mm-hmm. Of Bob Ross's work.
Cool.
Called Happy Little Trees. And I have a little quote on the back of the book or somewhere in the book a while ago. But I will send you that info because it's really way to kind of conceptualize him and his philosophies.
Yes. Yeah. I really do enjoy, I could just watch him all day. And it's not only because of the art, but the process. It is that like, he just does that so well. And I love that it's so, I feel like there's like a resurgence of Bob Ross lately and like it's becoming more mainstream and like those elements of acceptance and, you know, in creativity, which is so important.
Yeah. Oh, and it was just such a nice sensory experience because the canvas was mic'd. So you could hear all the little brush strokes and stuff.
So that's so cool. I didn't know that the canvas was mic'd. That is so cool.
So it kind of adds that rhythm. You get to hear like the
Yes. And I love that sound too. I like as you're saying it, I was like, oh my gosh, yes, I can hear it. Like that, all those brush strokes. But I had no idea they mic'd the canvas. That's such a great idea of getting, it's like a multi-sensory experience. Like you're really there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I always love watching like the thick paint that gets on there and seeing like kind of seeing that difference too, of like, you can see the, like physical pieces and lumps or, you know, streaks.
Yeah, I love the texture of it. You can almost like feel it. It's so kind of luscious, the texture.
Great.
And I think, and sometimes in my groups and sometimes in individual sessions, like really being a champion for the happy accident and really naming that too, like, and depending on the rapport and the group and what's needed. But I've definitely had many times in groups where an individual just felt like, I have to turn the paper over, I really messed up, and how I will kind of go the opposite and surprise them and be like, oh my God, that's so, so great. Let's look at this happy accident. And then a time to make choice, right? I could guide them and work with them on how to repurpose that accident. I've definitely had times where individuals have ripped up their whole paper and then we put it back together as a collage, or crumpled the paper and then we open it up and work with all the lines that are in the crumpled paper. Or you just throw it out. I mean, that's also can be a cathartic part of the process too.
But I just letting it go.
Start from a strength-based perspective and kind of champion the happy accident.
Yeah. And I love that we can do that so often and that we get a lot of opportunity for that of, you know, being creative, in so many different ways, like those. And I think too, this kind of actually goes back to the, making mistakes even within the therapeutic relationship.
Yes.
Like those are happy little accidents, like, and then you can figure out, you know, a strength-based way to utilize that. And, within the artwork, within the relationship, it's we have such a cool toolbox for doing those in multimodal ways.
Yeah, it makes me think of that. I also have been trained in motivational interviewing, and I actually love it. It's definitely not something that you necessarily get taught going to school for art therapy, but it has come up in some of the work that I did, especially around substance abuse, other individuals with personality disorders, severe mental illness. It's an evidence-based practice, but it also is just a really cool approach because it's really just reflective listening. And the times that I've been able to kind of name or reflect what I saw happening and actually get it wrong, and that and building that discrepancy actually opens up the client to actually, no, that's not what I was saying. And that actually kind of can open up the experience a little more.
Yeah, those moments are great. And even advocacy, like that's a great self-advocacy opportunity for, you know, to be like, I don't think it was, or that doesn't feel right. And sometimes I think that draws a person deeper into conceptualizing what they're, you know, trying to explain or something. That's awesome. I'm going to put a link to that also for motivational interviewing. I know that's something, at least in my program too, with music therapy, I've heard about it now afterwards, hearing about it in trainings about it. Yeah, that's such a great, another really great tool to have.
Yeah, I think it's primarily social work school that you learn that. But it's also just Carl Rogers who did primarily reflective listening. So it's very parallel to that.
Very cool. Well, Melissa, this has been so, so amazing. We've talked on so many cool topics, mindfulness, group work, perspective, compassionate inquiry. I just love hearing about all of these different, everybody's practice is so unique and creative in their own way. And it's just so cool that you shared yours with us. So thank you.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, totally. Well, can you tell our listeners too? I'm going to have lots of links to the stuff that we talked about, but where can listeners find you if they want to reach out to you?
Sure. So I have a few different ways.
Awesome.
I'm also an active studio artist. So my art site is melissadiazart.com. And there you kind of see my installation work, my sculpture work, my interactive work. So I try my best to keep that practice going, even though it's a very tough balance. I know that when I don't have it in my life, I am not the best human I can be, and I'm definitely not the best therapist I could be. And I also as someone who creates shows, curates, and exhibits, I also utilize that lens in my therapy work, and also have done a lot of work on exhibitions as an intervention in art therapy. So I try to kind of also be utilizing that for myself as well. So that's just my art website. Awesome. And I think there's also a link to my email on there. Cool. And then the Community Arts Initiative Open House BK, it's just openhousebk.com.
Cool.
Which stands for Open House Brooklyn. There isn't, it's kind of an archive right now because there hasn't been too much programming as of late. I've definitely had a lot of hats that I've been wearing. So yeah. And I'm also the, on the board for NYADA, the New York Art Therapy Association. Awesome. I'm the chapter delegate there. So that's another website to visit if you're interested and becoming a part of the New York Art Therapy Association, what it offers, what we, you know, so that's another, I think that's nyarttherapyassociation.org. I could be wrong.
No problem. I'll put that all in the show notes too.
And then New York Creative Arts Therapist, NY Creative Arts Therapist is where you could see me in my bio and other individuals I work with. And I'm on Instagram for my art, which is public. So, which is also a whole other interesting topic of kind of being an artist and being a therapist and what's public and what's not public. Mm-hmm. I've chosen to keep that public so I can keep my art out there and connect. Yeah, and that's just m_diaz_art. And you can see a lot of my current work there. And also on my Instagram is where I list shows that I'm in. And I think I'm in one next Friday. Yeah.
Awesome.
Next Friday at La Bodega Gallery, which is a really community-based gallery in South Slope. But yeah, so my Instagram usually has like updates of kind of what I have going on in my art therapy world, but mostly in my art world.
It's awesome to have both of those. Yeah. Like, we do really need to honor being creative individuals. Somebody just, I actually wanted to reach out to this person. They gave a presentation of, and they called it something of like when your art becomes only in your work and like you're not having your whatever your modality is happen or, you know, your creativity happen outside. I feel like that's a huge topic for creative arts therapists to have to navigate.
The balance is really challenging, and I think there's a certain fatigue when you're only creating with others or as a guide for others.
And in not in your own genuine way sometimes, you know, like I know with music, the big joke right now is Frozen 2 just came out on Friday.
Yes.
And I think I've sung Let It Go probably like 5,000 times. And so I'm like, all right, here's the next one for the next 7 years. Sing it like every day.
Yeah.
But so it's, you know, you do, you know, you're adapting your, not that I love Disney songs, but, you know, I wouldn't choose to play Frozen on my own time. So I hope to, it's definitely been a goal of mine to have like a whole episode dedicated to that. And I think I found somebody who might be really great. And she speaks on burnout and all this stuff too for helping professionals. I'm hoping that we can dig more into that because it's so important for us.
It's a really tough balance.
Definitely. Yes. Well, Melissa, this has been awesome. Thank you again so much for being on.
Yes. Thank you. This was a pleasure. I had a really good time. I'm going to do a very quick plug for a bill that's been sitting on Governor Cuomo's desk for a while. And also the best way to get that information would be from NYADA, from New York Art Therapy Association. or my Instagram. I've put some posts out about trying to get this bill passed so that creative arts therapists, LCATs, and licensed mental health counselors, I think there's one other type of clinician, could get covered by Medicaid because currently we cannot, which would open up a lot of availability and accessibility for our modalities to be utilized for individuals who are utilizing Medicaid, who are on the margins, who, you know, it just opens up a lot and makes us a lot more accessible and is so important.
It really is.
Field and for moving forward. So yeah, I just wanted to mention that we're trying to push it through December, and I could also send you a link.
Yes.
Where people can send an email and a letter to governor.
I love that. Yes. I'm huge on advocacy, and that's such an important, so many people, their only resource is Medicaid. Yeah. And, you know, traditional therapy or, you know, whatever their options are just may not be the best fit. And it's got to be really frustrating that, you know, to not, for the client to not be able to access what would best serve them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Yes, I love that. Go New York, man. So I just saw New Jersey. I think that they just passed the LCAT. Is it an LCAT or is it, it might be some, a different license?
I think it's an LPAT.
Yes, that, yes.
Yes. Congratulations, New Jersey.
I know. Yes. It's super exciting. I was like, oh man, just keep it coming. All that advocacy. Keep us growing. So awesome.
That was my last plug.
Perfect. I love the plugs because it's like, that's where the connection and community happens, where it's like, go talk to these people, go do this advocacy thing, go find these, make these connections. Cause that's what I'm hoping this does. It's, that's the whole purpose of it. So yes. Yeah. Awesome. Cool.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Melissa shared so many awesome resources, and I put as many of those links as possible in the show notes. So definitely go check some of that stuff out. It was such a pleasure talking with her and hearing about her passions, and I hope you guys enjoyed listening. Always feel free to reach out to us. You can email us at creativetherapyumbrella@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Instagram. Our handle is creativetherapyumbrella. We love reaching out, hearing from other people, and just talking and making that web, as we were describing earlier in this chat, bigger. So thank you guys again for listening, and be creative.